Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Sometime after Hamilton's bike races and before finishing the Red Hill Expressway. On April Fool's Day, we aired a skit on Disrespect called Deanny's Hamilton. We thought it was time to air it again. Larry Deanny has left us a number of legacies, one of which we misapprehended. We thought the Red Hill Expressway was going to be a parking lot, and instead it's Canada's longest swimming pool. To review the other accomplishments of that time, stay tuned for Deanny's Hamilton.
I know Deanny's very keen on contracting out of services as much as possible. He sees it logically as a way of depressing wages and attempting to give the same amount of service for a lack of a living wage and benefits and all those things that people normally expect when they're working from 9 to 5. And it just seems like yet another example of this daft logic that seems to rule over at City Hall these days.
If we can send the money out of town, our city will be a better place to live.
And look at places where they've tried contracting out.
Where?
Good example, the hospital in Prince Rupert, up the coast of British Columbia. And they, as a hospital, started contracting out their blood services. Seemed to them to make sense that they would send it out to a little laboratory, and they did all your blood tests. The hospital didn't do its blood tests anymore. It went right out to the lab, and they would type you and do all those tests. And so they didn't have to. The theory was, you don't hire technicians. You don't have to pay their salaries. Don't have to pay all their benefits and all that. And it all just gets shunted down the line. Well, it sounded great, except in a classic market economy system, they just sent it off to the lab, and of course, after a while, the lab said, "Oh yeah, we're going to increase your
rates,
your costs."
Yeah.
And after a while, they looked at their budget and they said, "If we started doing our own blood work again, we'd save about $100,000 every year."
Maybe that's the cycle then. Maybe we need to send it out to generate the savings when they up the cost
and
we bring it back.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Certainly, there's no political capital in continuing to save money.
No.
Can't announce that.
Well, it's like
we're continuing to save money.
The amalgamation process in Toronto and Hamilton, mm-hmm. And the theory is we bring all these cities together, we cut away all the excess waste, right, and all the excess administrators, and we have the same sort of services. Well, what happens in Toronto? I was working in Toronto at the time. Nobody lost their jobs. All these administrators got shunted off into little hidey holes in the bureaucracy, and you ended up with a whole new layer of bureaucracy over top of it all.
To manage process?
At the end, that's right, and at the end of the amalgamation process, they all stayed too. And so you got none of the savings, more of the bureaucrats, more of the budget. and now Toronto's looking at this horrible budget where they're threatening to either have to increase their taxes or starting to cut services. Have you noticed that our garbage pickup now downtown, if you're driving around late around the city, all those little garbage containers down by bus stops are not looked after by city employees anymore. If you notice, it's some guy in his Pontiac driving a flatbed that's homemade, and he's got a little yellow light on top of his thing, and they're driving around all over the place like lunatic. Well, it's late at night. You can drive like a lunatic, whatever. And he pulls in, gets out, gets this garbage, dumps it in, and away he goes. And you can see him as he drives off, and he's looking at his map trying to figure out where he's supposed to go next, right? It's a different guy all the time. It's never the same person. So, you know, they're subcontracting even that. Well, I don't know if you, I don't know if you know.
There's no retention rate, so they can't be much in it.
Well, and also, have you noticed that there's an awful lot of overflowing garbage?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Surprise. Wonder why. It's because they're, you know, you get what you pay for. You know, if you keep on cutting wages, you're going to get worse service. That's the way it works. Mm-hmm. You know, people are concerned about security at airports, right? Well, do you wonder why people, the guys working the security details, are so grumpy?
Yeah.
It's because they're not paid very much, and they don't care because they're not paid very much. So they do what they have to do. It's you have to pay. You want good service? Pay decent wages. Look after the people.
You hear that, Hamilton? There you go. Just as easy as that. Now we've solved that problem. Let's go international.
International war, that's right, yeah. The city seems to have fallen in love with the Bread and Circuses approach to running the, popularizing the city, and it always drives me mad. You know, we spend all this money on, like, the bike race, for instance, and they say we're going to bring the world to Hamilton, and it's this one-off affair where...
All right, it starts, it ends, we're deeper in debt.
Did they make a profit? Probably not. And so you're trying to sell it on, you know, people coming back to the city. Well, if the bike race is over...
Yeah, why are they coming back?
What are they coming
it's
back
winter
for? Well, this is
in
it.
In Hamilton.
That's right. Well, this is it. I mean, it makes no sense. I mean, you could do a Winterfest, for that matter, like a Winterlude. Like Ottawa and Quebec City have Winterludes all the time. I don't, you know, the fact that we don't get snow regularly anymore, we might not want to do something like that. But
and that it's gray.
Yeah, well...
It's different. The character of it would be different.
If you're going to spend tons of money on something like this, you want to have...
A cumulative effect.
Well, where it's not... You know, I mean, I honestly believe that we would have been much more efficient if we had have just taken all that money that we spent, piled it in front of City Hall, set a torch to it, and just enjoyed a little
people.
Fire. Yeah,
yeah, you know? Yeah, to the ceremony. Yeah. Well, that may come. Yes,
yeah,
that may come.
Well, the Commonwealth Games, I was never quite so happy as when I found out that it wasn't going to... Yeah,
I thought well of that, too. But what have we got a lot of in Hamilton that we could make a cumulative gain with? We've got a lot of poverty. We've got a lot of illness. we've got looming unemployment. And surely we can celebrate these in some meaningful way here. I don't know. A steelworker's pension burning, you know. Right in front of City Hall. We could do that.
People.
Oh, yeah, like poor people chasing cans of tuna.
Food, yeah.
They roll, too. Maybe if you put a stick, you know, it could acquire the status of an Olympic eventually.
Or betting, or...
Yeah, I understand that there's an issue. I understand that the city's idea was to put a casino in the middle of Jackson Square, that in fact, somebody told me, the food court was created, that's there now, was created originally as space for a casino. That's why all the money was spent, and that for some reason or other, it didn't go through.
Huh.
And so we have hot dogs there now instead
of a casino. You know that casino?
They do sell lottery tickets at the corner of that space.
Which is a form of gambling, I suppose.
No ladies in sequins, no cigarette girls, no.
That's right. Of course, you know, that might be a way of raising revenue for the city. I mean, they
don't bankrupt the city, bankrupt the citizens.
Well, that's the way this works, isn't it? I mean, you know, lotteries are basically a tax on the stupid. Well, think about the odds of winning, you know.
But think of it, we could have a return on our prostitution and our crime. Instead of it just spontaneously erupting in front of your veranda.
All those social problems, you make sure that you have a drug law-free zone around the gambling area so that, you know, once the pimps have got all that money, then they're naturally drawn into the...
So you recoup your drug money. even as your citizens become addicted.
Poor...
Yeah. Well, the only problem with that is if it were at Jackson Square, City Hall would probably fall in that zone.
Yeah.
Can't go there.
No, best not to.
But think of the breaks you could get. Parking enforcement would be in there, too.
Yeah.
Let me off my ticket because I have a hot tip for you for the casino. I've often thought that the city's parking policy is something that would change the face of the city for business here if they didn't put parking enforcement officers under manhole covers so that you park your car, go in to get change for the meter, and come out, and there's a $25 ticket on it. You know, this might change the way people regard the city. Well, for the sake of the revival of the city, there's the Red Hill Expressway and all the money that they're spending on that. I don't know if you can say anything funny about that.
What?
We build an expressway. Many trucks come belching smoke and gas, and the expressway is crowded. It's jammed, and the trucks are stopped and idling. And there's that parking issue that we spoke about. You can walk up the expressway and ticket all the trucks. You know, think of the money that would bring for the city.
It also defies logic from the point of view of if this is supposed to bring business to the city, mm-hmm. right? This is the theory of linking us up with all sorts of other systems, right? Mm-hmm. What would be the function of a highway that links?
It bypasses.
Well, this is it exactly, isn't it?
Yeah.
It will be used to bypass the city.
Right.
It's not going to bring stuff into the city. It's going to be so people can get away that much more quickly from Hamilton. You know, you always know that your community's in severe danger when your downtown core gets taken
Centers
over
around.
By
Centers
bingos.
Around.
Check cashers and the corner stores. You know, when you got corner stores in your downtown core,
and they're not even on the corner,
and that's you're heading in the wrong direction. But it doesn't have to be like that. I mean, there are lots of cities that have been able to turn themselves around. Boston, you know, look at Boston. I visited Boston in the 70s, and it was a war zone, an absolute war zone. Like there were literally rubble buildings in the middle of the town. But they were quite successfully turned themselves around. But you have to invest in your town, not in the roads that make people want to get away from your town, you know.
And of course, what's going to happen with that is the withdrawal of money from social services. They have made no commitment to do so, but I mean, it's inevitable. When you don't have money, it comes out of soft things first, because if you take it out of hard things, they crumble and people complain.
Well, and that ties in with, have you noticed how our water rates are going up dramatically? What's the city doing? They raise our water rates and they build a highway that's got no point.
Right.
Why not keep our water rates the same and take all that money that we're going to spend and put it into infrastructure like our water, you know?
There's a couple of winter events that you just brought to mind. I mean, we could run like a book on where the sewers are going to explode this winter. And in fact,
water main bingo.
I understand it's quite, spectacular. We could, in fact, even invite people from out of town, you know, to take part and slosh around. We did that last winter. We actually had someone with a tape sloshing around in the water as it rushed past and asking people what they thought of this on Lock Street.
Well, do you know, I live not too far away from Lock Street, and there were, at the time that the break happened, there were kids with skates skating down the road.
There you go. And we didn't charge them.
No, well, there's another lost revenue source.
That's right. If social services go on the bum, we already have a program where they claim to lost documents to encourage people not to reapply and not to qualify for their $500 or $525, I think it is, a month. I hesitate to think what program with more money taken out would look like, or a special needs program for people who need supports like orthotics or aids at home, whatever, where they also you call up and they also tell you, you know, we've lost your documents, or you think your doctor sent your documents but we never got them, sort of thing, and then you go back and they send them again and they say no, we still didn't get them, sort of thing. I can't imagine what it would be like. But you mentioned another revenue source, I recall, recently reducing the number of disabled people and raising money at the same time.
You thought. Selling our disabled for firewood,
There you go. There.
Or as firewood, you know, it's... Yeah.
I thought that was tenable in this kind of future.
Well,
this post-apocalyptic expressway future.
Now for a break in our usual penetrating interview, Eric Clapton, further on up the road.
Thank you. like you hurt me. While they're on the road, baby, just you wait and see. You've been laughing pretty, baby. Someday you're gonna be crying. You've been laughing pretty, baby. Someday you're gonna be crying. While they're on the road, you'll find out I wasn't lying.
Where the turnaround really comes, how the Red Hill Valley desecration really gets stopped. I wonder, could we chop down City Hall?
You gotta figure out a way of letting all the people who aren't, it's not really their fault, letting them know that they really shouldn't be going there, you know. You know, you need
so that's not possible. Well, well, we haven't got enough counselors to stop the thing. I understand that one lone Six Nations fella has launched a lawsuit on the strength of a 1701 treaty, and he's in a direct lineage from the natives who signed the treaty. So he's a direct descendant, and then he's launched a lawsuit against the Red Hill.
Single-handedly.
Single-handedly, yes. The Six Nations are not behind him in any formal way.
Wow.
And that this is the last chance to stop the work. And whether the city wants to ignore one man with a hatchet or not is...
That would be truly ironic, wouldn't it? If
one man, yeah.
Once again, well, just think about, you know, think about the Meech Lake Accord that was canned not too long ago. I mean, it was held up in Manitoba by a single native MPP holding a feather, Elijah Harper, and refusing assent to pass the bill unanimously that killed the Meech Lake Accord.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was Elijah Harper in Manitoba, and he I always found it rather ironic that, you know, a representative of a First Nation who viewed themselves as being allied to Canada but not part of Canada was actually willing to stand up for all the rest of us. It would be ironic that if that the creek might be saved by yet another First Nations person. Those are long odds, though.
I wanted to touch on the question of disability in Red Hill, too. I've heard that the McMaster University Hamilton Health Sciences is already scheduling training sessions for staff to deal with the lung-related diseases that are expected to follow from the opening of the Red Hill Expressway in Hamilton and its famous penny-wise, pound-foolish way has engaged a multi-million-dollar corporation to deal with the consequences of its expressway.
Well, that seems kind of wrong-headed, doesn't it? I mean, when you consider that the city council seems to be doing so well at driving business out of the city, I mean, that's going to reduce all our pollution anyways, so...
It's true.
You know, the new expressway would just kind of be replacing it. One would think that the level of lung-related problems would probably remain about the same.
Yeah. Just move. Move east.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
To where the young kids are. Well, we'll have to revisit this when the Red Hill issue is clearer and the city's fortunes are probably clearer, too. I really appreciate you coming in to talk this over with us, and I hope our listeners take it in the spirit in which it was intended.
Maddening. Absolutely maddening.
And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These are not the stories that we read to you from the paper. These are abbreviations of the stories from the papers we name in the broadcast. Energy. Panel assails Ottawa's changes to Mackenzie Pipeline report. Proposed federal changes to a report on the Mackenzie Valley gas pipeline will weaken environmental protection and fail to ensure that Northerners enjoy maximum benefits from the project, says the panel that reviewed the project. The 16-page document says Environment Canada has rejected many of the suggestions most necessary to monitor the cumulative effects of the pipeline. As well, many recommendations accepted in principle have been weakened by removing any commitment to follow through. Ottawa has said many of the rejected recommendations, such as those concerning greenhouse gases and monitoring of cumulative effects, were outside the panel's jurisdiction. The panel counters by saying it was asked to look not only at the specific effects of the project, but also at any development it would spur. The government's conclusions fail to recognize the likely longer-term cumulative impacts resulting from a range of possible future developments that are likely and reasonably foreseeable. It lacks commitments to send resource royalties to the territorial government to fund an expected heavier demand on health, social, and justice programs. The panel wants an independent agency to monitor the government's environmental and social promises. That from the Canadian Press, byline Bob Weber in the Globe. First Nations kids excluded from plan. Most vulnerable won't have access to new program, critics say. While Ontario projects almost half of all kindergarten students will be in full-day programs by the fall of 2012, Native education is a federal responsibility, and the plan is not offered in First Nations-run schools, said Regional Chief Angus Toulouse of the Chiefs of Ontario. The province has not extended their early learning initiative to First Nations, and they are not planning to, Toulouse said. The investment required to support full-day kindergarten on reserves needs to come from the federal government, according to Aaron Moroz, a spokesperson for Education Minister Leona Dombrowski. Cindy Blackstock, executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada, pointed out that Ontario supports Jordan's principle. The principle states that children on reserve should not be denied access to services available to all other kids because of jurisdictional disputes between the federal and provincial governments. Jordan Anderson of Norway House Cree Nation spent 2 years in hospital unnecessarily because the Manitoba and federal government couldn't agree on who should pay for his medical care at home. He died in hospital at age 5. Ontario has adopted Jordan's principle, a private member's motion passed unanimously by the House of Commons in 2007, but only for health and social services and not education, said Blackstock. We don't understand why this would be the case, she said. We take the view that all children are sacred and they are all entitled to government services. NDP MPP Howard Hampton, Kenora Rainy River, said First Nations children would benefit the most from the provincial program, but are being shut out. That story from the Star, Tanya Talaga, Queen's Park Bureau. While Ontario projects almost half of all kindergarten students will be in full-day programs by the fall of 2012, accessible voting site too far for some. Provincial rules mandating access for disabled lead to fewer, more distant polling stations. Lillian Ramsuchit, 59, just had double knee surgery. She also has breathing problems. So do her friends, Sonadai Muklal, 69, Rotia Chauharja, and Kuzum Hamid, both 71. The women are longtime residents of Lotherton Pathway, a diverse community just off Caledonia Road in Toronto. It contains 744 units, 88 townhouses, and thousands of potential voters, many of them low-income seniors who don't have a car. For as long as they can remember, the women have voted on the main floor of one of the buildings. Except this year. Now they have to walk to Joyce Public School, about a half kilometer away. The advanced polling station at the Glen Long Community Center is even farther away. City spokesperson Carol Boenham explained that the poll was moved because of stricter adherence to the province's Election Act, which requires clerks to ensure all voting locations are accessible to electors with disabilities. City documents show that in 2006, voting was held in the complex's recreation room, which has three flights of stairs and as such would not be accessible to people with disabilities. In the last municipal election, there were 1,637 polling stations. This time, there were 75 fewer to serve about 5,500 more voters than 4 years ago. It's not just the four of us, Ram Sushit said. The other women nodded in agreement, mumbling that it is just too far to walk for over half the people who live there. If they don't have the polling station here, they will miss a lot of votes. Ram Sushit said her previous experiences voting on site have been very comfortable. You take the elevator. There's a ramp. I don't know what the city is talking about. Josh Colley, who's running in the local ward, Ward 15, Eglinton Lawrence, says the city is hiding behind wheelchair accessibility. That from the Star, Jane Poisson, staff writer. Special drug plan mired in months-long backlog. Ontario patients waiting up to 5 months to get prescriptions approved. Feelings of nausea and achiness were eclipsed by relief for Paul Thompson as he finally received an overdue drug to treat a severe case of Crohn's disease. A backlog in a provincial program that pays for medication not normally covered under the Ontario drug plan meant he had to wait 10 weeks. I feel awful, but I'm just glad to be finally getting the drug, he said from the clinic where he was being treated. I just think it's terrible that bureaucratic red tape is making people like me get this ill again. The province has confirmed the time needed to process requests to its exceptional access program has recently stretched to 5 months from 8 to 12 weeks. Urgent requests are being turned around within 10 business days. The program helps patients in exceptional circumstances get access to drugs not funded under the Ontario Drug Benefit Plan. Dr. Hilary Steinhardt, head of gastroenterology at Toronto's Mount Sinai Hospital, where Thompson is being treated, said where approvals once took 4 to 6 weeks, they are now taking twice as long. I'm concerned about it, he said, adding the delays are frustrating. Steinhardt said delays can compromise a patient's health because in the interim, the patient's body can develop antibodies to the drug itself, making it less effective and liable to cause an allergic reaction when it's resumed. Toronto Star, Wednesday, October 13th, byline Teresa Boyle, health reporter. Programs for disabled called too complex. Better coordination needed, says OECD. Canadians with disabilities or health problems are caught in a complex web of federal and provincial programs that make it almost impossible for them to join or remain in the workforce, says a new OECD report. Few programs lift the disabled out of poverty, and many seem to work at cross purposes, says the report by the Paris-based Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which looked at the major disability benefits and services offered by Ottawa and the province. Provinces. The 85-page report comes on the eve of a promised Ontario review of social assistance and mirrors many of the recommendations of a provincial expert panel that called for more coordination of federal and provincial programs for vulnerable working-age people. Like many OECD countries, the report notes Canada's benefits and services are focused on what the sick and disabled cannot do rather than on what meaningful work they are able to do. Mary Maroney of Ontario's Income Security Advocacy Centre welcomed the report's recommendation that Canada and other countries need to focus on people's abilities, not their disabilities. But she is concerned about the report's suggestion that countries should tie disability benefits to a person's efforts to work, even part-time. Michael Mendelson of the Caledon Institute of Social Policy said Canada would be unwise to adopt one-stop shopping for the disabled before reforming the various federal and provincial programs. Then in the Star by Laurie Monsebraten, social justice reporter. New housing for homeless men welcomed. Nervous neighbors now on side with facility that is a first in Canada. In March, Wood Green Community Services unveiled First Step to Home, the country's first transitional housing project for homeless men over age 55, with wraparound support, including on-site health care, counseling, and meals. Toronto's population of homeless men is aging. An estimated 3,500 of the 23,000 adults and youth who used the shelter system last year are over 50. Their age, addictions, physical and mental health problems make them more likely to be robbed or beaten in shelters and on the streets. Wood Green Community Services felt this group required transitional housing geared to their needs. Federal funding, along with donations from TD Bank President Ed Clark, employees of RBC Capital Markets, the Canadian Tire at Lakeshore Boulevard East, and Chartis Insurance, helped make it happen. The men, who range in age from 55 to 84, sign yearly contracts and can live in the building for up to 4 years. Many will move on to live independently in the community, while some of the frail elderly will move into long-term care. Last Christmas, after several years of living in city shelters, Kelly Glover, 55, suffered 2 heart attacks. The Edwin Hotel has been critical to his survival, he says. I can't say enough good about this place, says the gregarious Irishman, who sports white shoulder-length hair. I'm hoping to stay for a couple of years, turn things around. Real estate agent David Eakins marvels at how well the new Edwin has integrated into the neighborhood. It definitely hasn't affected property values in our building. In fact, it has improved the neighborhood. That by Laurie Monsebraten again in the Toronto Star, Friday, October 15th. We need a dementia strategy, not grandpa prisons. Like many who care for loved ones with Alzheimer's disease, Rose McLeod uses visual clues to trigger memories. On this particular morning, she took out a wedding photo and marriage certificate to remind her husband of 48 years that they were indeed married. Joe McLeod responded angrily to the woman before him, convinced she was a stranger who had come into his home to do harm. Confused, he pushed her away brusquely. Rose fell to the ground, the framed wedding photo shattered, and the glass cut her badly. Police were called. Rose didn't want to press charges. Told it was the only way her husband could get help, she agreed reluctantly. Joe McLeod, Alzheimer's patient, suddenly became Joe McLeod, wife beater. And this is where the story truly turns Kafkaesque. Joe didn't get help. He spent more than a month in jail. He suffered a lot, scared and confused. That's because his wife, the person who cared for him around the clock, was forbidden from seeing him because she was considered a victim of domestic violence. On October 9th, Joe was granted bail and a bed was finally found for him in a long-term care facility. He would have spent even longer had his case not become a media cause célèbre. This is a travesty of justice. When a sick person urinates in public, shoplifts, trashes the family home, or hits someone during a psychotic outburst, the police always say the same thing, press charges and they will get help. But the help too rarely comes. Let's state it plainly so that politicians, judges, physicians, and others in positions of responsibility understand it is unacceptable to jail someone with Alzheimer's. Psychosis is a common symptom of Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. It needs to be treated, not punished. We don't need grandpa prisons. We need a dementia strategy. Joe was asked by the judge, Sandra Chapman, if he would comply with his bail conditions. I will do my best, he said. If only the legal and health systems would vow to do the same for him and the 500,000 other Canadians who suffer from dementia. This by Andre Picard in the Globe and Mail, Thursday, October 14th. province to inject $2.3 million into local community care budget. Ontario says the Hamilton Area Community Care Access Centre is receiving a $2.3 million increase in its base funding to, quote, address their needs, unquote. The agency, which oversees home and long-term care, said it's facing a $5 million deficit on its $233 million budget. Alan Iskew, interim CEO of the Hamilton Niagara Haldeman Brandt Local Health Integration Network, said the money is part of the ministry's announcement for increased funding for the entire sector, not specifically the Hamilton area. While the promised $2.3 million will offset the deficit, the province has not addressed the issue of backlogs and cost cuts the CCAC is making because of increasing demand. The province upped the cap on home care to 90 hours a month from 60 hours and eliminated the limit for certain patient groups. But the local CCAC says the change wasn't followed up with funding. Low-risk patients will be placed on wait lists for services, and new home care clients will only get one bath per week unless they are incontinent. Other clients will be sent to community nursing clinics instead of having home care come to them. One bath a week, eh? Stinks to me. By Daniel Wong in The Spectator. Liberals vow to fix retirement homes. The problems in retirement homes, exposed by an undercover star investigation, should be easier to root out once new regulations are in place next year, says Ontario's Minister for Seniors. Sophia Aguilinaitis told the legislature on Monday that the newspaper's probe deeply saddened and shocked her, but she vowed that once long-anticipated legislation takes effect next year, things should improve. Star reporter Dale Brazeo went undercover for a week in West Toronto's In Touch retirement home, discovering seniors abandoned for hours to fester in urine and feces-filled diapers with no toilet paper in bathrooms, substandard food, and other poor conditions. Advocates reacted with frustration to the minister's comments, saying the new law won't help vulnerable residents. Advocates fear an industry-dominated authority with too much discretion. Judith Wall of the Advocacy Center for the Elderly said the ministry is more interested in meeting the demands of the retirement homeowners than protecting vulnerable residents. We told them it is people who are poor, the people with no other options, who also live there. I don't think they get that yet, Wall said. NDP MPP Franz Gelinas, Nickel Belt, said the Retirement Homes Act, which passed on June 2nd, is deeply flawed and reckless because the companies will police themselves through the new Ontario Retirement Home Regulatory Authority. Progressive Conservative MPP Christine Elliott said the Star series undermined Premier Dalton McGuinty's long-stated goal for seniors to be treated with respect and dignity. Today, it means urine-stained retirement homes that leave unbathed and incapacitated residents stranded for half an hour in dirty bathrooms, lying prone on the floor and sitting in soiled adult diapers for hours. Residents supply their own toilet paper. Meals are hot dogs, macaroni and cheese, and cold cuts, said Elliott. We need to do a lot better, she said, urging a comprehensive review of seniors' living conditions in these homes. That from The Star by Robert Benzie and Wyra Welsh, staff reporters. The disgrace at Veterans Affairs. The breaches of faith in the case of Sean Brouillet is a blot on the department's record and a stain on the Canadian government, writes J.L. Granatstein. Under its new name, Veterans Affairs Canada has besmirched its record, perhaps irrevocably. Modern-era veterans, those who served in the Persian Gulf, the former Yugoslavia, or in Afghanistan, have long believed themselves shortchanged by the department and successive governments, and some of the complaints have become vociferous.
I wonder where the turnaround really comes, how the Red Hill Valley desecration really gets stopped. I wonder, could we chop down City Hall?
You gotta figure out a way of letting all the people who aren't, it's not really their fault, letting them know that they really shouldn't be going there, you know.
So that's not possible.
Well, you know.
Well, we haven't got enough counselors to stop the thing. I understand that one lone Six Nations fella has launched a lawsuit on the strength of a 1701 treaty, and he's in a direct lineage from the natives who signed the treaty. So he's a direct descendant, and then he's launched a lawsuit against the Red Hill
single-handedly.
Single-handedly, yes. The Six Nations are not behind him in any formal way.
Wow.
And that this is the last chance to stop the work. I mean, whether the city wants to ignore one man with a hatchet or not is... That would be truly ironic,
wouldn't it? If
one man, yeah.
Once again, well, just think about, you know, think about the Meech Lake Accord that was canned not too long ago. I mean, it was held up in Manitoba by a single native MPP holding a feather, Elijah Harper, and refusing assent to pass the bill unanimously that killed the Meech Lake Accord.
I didn't know that.
It was Elijah Harper in Manitoba, and he I always found it rather ironic that, you know, a representative of a First Nation who viewed themselves as being allied to Canada but not part of Canada was actually willing to stand up for all the rest of us. It would be ironic that if the creek might be saved by yet another First Nations person. Those are long odds, though.
I wanted to touch on the question of disability in Red Hill, too. I've heard that the McMaster University Hamilton Health Sciences is already scheduling training sessions for staff to deal with the lung-related diseases that are expected to follow from the opening of the Red Hill Expressway in Hamilton and its famous penny-wise, pound-foolish way has engaged a multi-million-dollar corporation to deal with the consequences of its expressway.
Well, that seems kind of wrong-headed, doesn't it? I mean, when you consider that the city council seems to be doing so well at driving business out of the city. I mean, that's going to reduce all our pollution anyways, so...
It's true.
You know, the new expressway would just kind of be replacing. One would think that the level of lung-related problems would probably remain about the same.
Yeah. Just move. Move east.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
To where the young kids are. Well, we'll have to revisit this when the Red Hill issue is clearer and the city's fortunes are probably clearer, too. I really appreciate you coming in to talk this over with us, and I hope our listeners take it in the spirit in which it was intended.
Maddening. Absolutely maddening.
The Veterans Ombudsman, Colonel Pat Stogren, who commanded the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry in Afghanistan in 2002, has pushed the department hard to make improvements in benefits. So too has retired Captain Sean Bruyer, a 14-year Air Force vet with service in the Persian Gulf War. After Mr. Bruyer started criticizing the department in 2005 over a new veterans charter that changed the compensation package for wounded vets with its plan to pay lump sums, he suddenly found access to the treatment he required to treat his post-traumatic stress disorder cut off. The department then demanded that he get a psychiatric assessment. When Mr. Bruyer later secured access to his file, he discovered that his records had been passed around Veterans Affairs offices. "Folks, it's time to take the gloves off here," one senior official wrote. So off came the gloves, and Mr. Bruyer lost access to the care and treatment he needed. In other words, the bureaucrats decided to try to shut up a critic who was interfering with the implementation of their plans, and they used his medical records to help them do so. Canada's Privacy Commissioner, Jennifer Stoddard, has confirmed Mr. Bruyer's account, and she's now looking into claims of bureaucratic abuse at Veterans Affairs as a whole. But the commissioner's powers to punish are limited. We need a formal inquiry. People need to suffer the consequences of their actions because it's the only way they would learn and other employees learn as well, said Mr. Bruyer's wife, Carolina. She's right. Veterans are citizens with rights to privacy, and because of their overseas service in times of war, even more entitlement to their nation's care and consideration is deserved. If the public's confidence is to be restored, there must be an investigation with punishment for those who tried to smear opponents. Nothing less will suffice. Again by J.L. Granat Stein in The Star. Soldiers' stress disorder hurts kids. According to preliminary Canadian study, some kids struggle with the psychological and physical fallout of their parents' post-traumatic stress disorder. Deborah Harrison, a sociology professor at the University of New Brunswick and co-author of the paper, said adolescents living with parents with PTSD can face physical abuse, emotional neglect, and unpredictable rage. It changes their life and it completely changes the situation at home, she said, before presenting her paper at a conference in Toronto. It's a crisis like any other kind of major illness or violence in the home. Greg Lubomiv, a counselor at the Phoenix Center in Petawawa, said he is seeing an increasing number of military kids in his practice suffering from the reflected stresses of PTSD. The therapist said families can go through a range of emotions, such as guilt, anger, frustration, sorrow, and confusion, as they come to terms with the fact that their parent has been altered. And on the good news end of our review this week, Bell Canada President George Cope, whose mother raised him and two sisters as she battled depression, has stepped up with an unprecedented $50 million company investment into a four-year national mental health initiative. Research has shown that two-thirds of people with a mental illness don't seek help because of the stigma. That's the part that's so incredible and sad, Cope said, to have people feel uncomfortable when the treatment can be so successful. Cope spoke to The Star on the eve of Bell's Celebrity Gala, an annual charity event that took place at the Metro Toronto Convention Centre. All funds raised at the gala this year will go to the Centre for Addiction and Mental Health. CAMH will also get a significant chunk of the $50 million investment. As well as addressing stigma, Bell's initiative will invest in research, workplace health, and improved access to services for people who live far from major health centers. Adds CAMH President Dr. Catherine Zahn, in a heartbeat, it changes the game. Cope said Bell hopes to lead by example with its investment into what is an extremely underfunded area of the healthcare system. Mental illness represents 15% of Canada's healthcare burden, but receives only 5% of healthcare funding. That from Amy Dempsey, staff reporter, The Star. Chronic Disease Network launched, Vancouver. Family doctors across Canada hope to better manage chronic diseases by accessing information from a new national network that collects patients' electronic medical records. The Health Research Network will store information about five chronic diseases: depression, diabetes, hypertension, osteoarthritis, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And doctors can use it to decide how best to treat their patients. The federal government announced $11.7 million in funding for the project over the next 5 years. Treasury Board President Stockwell Day told a news conference that two out of five adults, including four of five seniors, are affected by the chronic diseases. A network like this is going to be beneficial beyond just Canada, he said. I believe there are already people looking at it from an international perspective. That from the Canadian Press via the Globe and Mail, Friday, October 15th. And that's all the news we have this week. But come back next week. You know, there will be more. And now to take us out, Rufus Thomas and Blues in the Basement.
Here I feel.
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number 4, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.